Welcome to the Everything is a Primary Source podcast, the show where pop culture is analyzed in order to create history. I'm your host, Eric Paul. This episode touches on the Civil War's presence in American pop culture by way of two artifacts, Ulysses S. Grant's memoirs, published in 1875, and the National Civil War Wax Museum, which opened in Gettysburg, Pennsylvania in April 1962. With a pair of interviews that were recorded on the same day last summer. I'm not exactly sure why these artifacts connected to the Civil War were selected from my assortment of pop culture memorabilia back to back like that. Maybe it's a testament to how the war is always with us. Here's the first interview.
All right, we are back with Ken, and he's waiting for Little Shop of Horrors to begin here at Prescott Park in Portsmouth, New Hampshire. And this is a great night for an outdoor performance.
It's beautiful. It's a beautiful night. Everybody should be right here.
It would be. And by the time you're listening to this, it may be as late as October or November when you just have to look forward to next year and
be
hope
a
for the
chillier.
Best. But I got Portsmouth. Are you from around here?
Yes. My original ancestors lived in Durham in the late 1600s to early 1700s.
So you're about as native as you can get, huh?
But I'm from Barnstead, which is in the central part of.
Yeah, I know Barnstead. I live in Milton, so we're not terribly far
Quite
from each
close.
Other.
Yes.
We gotta come down here for our culture and all that.
Yeah, absolutely.
On my table, you selected it's both volumes combined into one from Penguin Press. This is the Ulysses S. Grant's personal memoir. And I would say that one stands out probably as about as early as you can get for popular culture.
Okay.
Right. Because when I think about pop culture, American pop culture, I usually think of the 1920s as the beginning of really everybody sharing in the same stories and magazines and, you know, everything across the country.
Right.
If there's anybody at all, though, that particularly in the North that everybody knew of by the time that he wrote this, it would be Ulysses S. Grant, right?
Yeah, he certainly was known by everyone, that's for sure.
Yeah, I mean, he was the hero of the Union. He was the reason why, a lot of people credited him with winning the Civil War and defending the Republic and everything. And he was rewarded for that right after the Civil War by being elected president twice. But his later years were not nearly, even his presidential years were pretty bad, but full of corruption. But he was really ill when he wrote down his memoirs. So the question I selected is why did he write his personal memoirs down?
Well, number one, he was poor. He was not a good judge of money, and he did not have a good amount of money, and he was sick. He was getting sick, and I'm sure he was thinking about his wife and how she was going to be able to exist. Plus, he got this money from
Mark Twain.
He got his money from Mark Twain. And Mark Twain thought highly of him and thought that he would do a good job and it would be worthwhile to him. He died before he finished. It was almost at the end when he finished. And it became very, very popular. And it was a very, very good thing for his wife. So Mark Twain did an excellent thing to a friend.
Yeah.
And that was good. It's a long, long story that Grant wrote about his early days that were not successful. He worked in a store. And didn't do a good job in the store. He, for some reason, he was not successful at doing that.
And he graduated towards the bottom of his class at West Point.
And it's amazing. He was one of the ones that did not go far at West Point. And so you would think that would be the end of things. And they were until the war started. And there were those generals that were selected because they were good peacetime generals, like McDonnell, I guess.
McClellan and...
What?
McClellan?
McClellan.
Yeah.
McClellan was a great general when there wasn't a war going on. He dressed well, and he had his troops marching well, but he was afraid. He was fearful, and he wouldn't pursue the enemy and allowed Lee to escape on several occasions, and other generals mm-hmm. besides him. So he was really a terrible general. Grant was just going along. He just was an okay person in an officer's position until he got into one particular conflict where I can't remember the name of it, but it was early in his lifetime as an officer in the Civil War, and he was very successful. And mainly he was successful because he'd fight.
Yeah.
In fact, he continued to do that, and to the extent that Lincoln said, I like this general because he'll fight. And so Lincoln wanted to push him up the order of generals, too, and did.
I think Lincoln was definitely a visionary. He was a very modern person.
Yep.
He really, he's part of the reason why the country did have almost a second start. You know, the Civil War marks the beginning of the second era of the country.
But when you think about it, the early days, there was a lot of concerns about a national government. And if you read about what Hamilton had to say and what he was concerned about,
yeah.
each state having its own bank and how this would destroy America. So there was that issue. In fact, the governor of New York, Clinton, was very much in favor of having an independent bank for New York.
Mm-hmm.
And so that was a thought process going on, especially in the South. And so the war ended that.
Right. It made
it
one
made us one country.
Country,
unfortunately, for the thoughts in the South even to today, perhaps.
Yeah.
It was a very important thing.
And Grant, he's responsible for ushering in a new age of warfare that kind of supported that, of the all-out total war, you know, unconditional yeah. surrender Grant, it was
yeah.
his nickname. And I remember reading the memoirs, and there's really nothing in it about his presidency. And why would there be? Most of it is the Civil War. And I remember learning that Mark Twain pushed him on that. He's like, people want to know about
Yeah.
the war.
But the United States had the vice president that moved up, whose name I can't remember right now.
Johnson.
What, Johnson, who was awful. He was despicable. He took what gains that had occurred and turned them around and had the people that were in control in the individual states in the South regain control again.
Yeah.
Just a terrible, terrible individual. Grant understood that, and he wanted to be president again because he wanted to end what Johnson had created.
That two steps forward, two steps back. I mean, the Reconstruction era was not, especially for African Americans, not a new era. It was
right.
a lot of, just more of the same in many
yeah.
ways.
Yeah.
So this book is very much a product of that new America that he had a huge hand
absolutely
in
absolutely.
Creating.
He had thoughts of the future, and that part was tremendous that he had that. There's another thing that you didn't mention from the standpoint of the South. Lee, who I have a great deal of respect for as a general and as a human, unfortunately he was for the South, but nevertheless he was very, very good, started trench warfare. And this happened at Cold Harbor because he was running out of troops. And Lee was an engineer. And Lee created trenches and created a situation where Grant was full steam ahead, didn't understand trench warfare, and lost huge numbers of people to his end day, and I'm sure it's in here. He rued that he did not do things differently there because a lot of Northern soldiers died.
That battle was a massacre for the.
It was an absolute massacre, but that was studied for the next 50 years, and during World War I, what Lee came up with then was used in trench warfare.
That's true.
So Lee was responsible.
Yeah, he was a visionary in his own right.
Yeah.
Just didn't last much longer after the war, as granted. Thank you so much for stopping by to talk about this.
Absolutely.
You know, that book, like I said, it might be one of the earliest versions of pop culture, and we're not sitting very far from another person that Mark Twain had interaction with. Thomas Bailey Aldrich's house is right over there.
Wow.
And Twain was there when they opened that museum because he was a friend of Aldrich. People think that it was Aldrich's book, The Story of a Bad Boy, which is about his youth here in Portsmouth, was the inspiration for Tom Sawyer and Huckleberry Finn.
Oh, my gosh.
So it all comes, you know, without those stories, Mark Twain would not have been in a position to bankroll Grant.
Well, he
you
did.
Know, so that book
that
doesn't exist without any of this.
Okay.
I love it all. Thank you so much for stopping by,
yes,
Ken.
My pleasure.
The idea of continuous reflection of the Civil War and its aftermath in our collective culture is best explained by historian Barbara Fields.
I think what we need to remember most of all is that the Civil War is not over until we today have done our part in fighting it, as well as understanding what happened when the Civil War generation fought it.
This is from the final episode of the Ken Burns documentary masterpiece, The Civil War, from 1990.
William Faulkner said once that history is not was, it's is. And what we need to remember about the Civil War is that the Civil War is, in the present as well as in the past. The generation that fought the war, the generation that argued over the definition of the war, the generation that had to pay the price in blood, that had to pay the price in blasted hopes and a lost future, also established a standard that will not mean anything until we have finished the work. You can say there's no such thing as slavery anymore, we're all citizens. But if we're all citizens, then we have a task to do to make sure that that too is not a joke. If some citizens live in houses and others live on the street, the Civil War is still going on. It's still to be fought, and regrettably, it can still be lost.
Professor Fields' ideas are absolutely worth pondering, and I believe are underscored with the second conversation.
All right, Abby is with me in Prescott Park. We're getting ready for Little Shop of Horrors, and I know you're going to be performing in that very shortly. So thank you for taking the time to be with me here for Everything is a Primary Source podcast live, where we are doing podcast karaoke. And all the stuff on my table is meant to catch people's eye and say, oh, how do I, you know, what can I make of this? How does this tell me something about the past? And from my table, you selected a program for a wax museum.
Yeah.
Have you ever been to a wax museum?
They've always scared me.
Yeah, me too.
I've always been freaked out by them, but I really do like more about like the Civil War, though, than wax museums itself.
Because that one, because just to describe what I'm talking to folks about, it's like this is Madame Tussauds wax, or I don't know, Tussauds, whatever that wax, you know, famous one is, or like Ripley's Believe It or Not. Like, I get more creeped out by them because they're so realistic looking.
Mm.
These ones scare me for a different reason, but it's like kind of comforting, like they are guaranteed to be waxed because they're such bad-looking mannequins. Like, if they were real people, they wouldn't actually be able to live. They're that creepy. But you decided to chew off probably the biggest pop culture topic, and that's the Civil War itself.
Yeah.
And this will begin hour number, you know, we'll get about 8 hours of conversation on this.
Absolutely.
But I am a Civil War nut. I've been loving learning about the Civil War. You're telling me before we hit record that you are actually, you're from Columbia originally, right?
Yeah, I'm from Columbia, and I was able to grow up in Massachusetts. And last summer, I was working for the Boston Duck Tours. So we did a lot of history about like the American Revolution, and we did a lot about like the Civil War, about Harriet Tubman, and we did a lot about the 54th Regiment of Massachusetts.
You probably passed by that.
Yeah.
And I love that embossment. It's not really a statue. It's more of like a plaque, I guess.
Yeah. Out
near the State House.
Yeah.
On Beacon Hill there, that primary source, that monument, inspired the movie Glory. Which is one of my all-time favorite movies.
With, and, like, Ferris Bueller. I forget his name, but...
It's so hard, because at that time, I remember when I watched that for the first time, and I fell in love with that movie when I saw it as a... You know, I was probably about 8 years old when it came out, maybe a little bit younger. And, but knowing that was Ferris Bueller is kind of weird. I'm like...
Yeah.
Aren't you supposed to be pranking that guy to get out of school? Like, why are you, you know, ordering people around and being mean to...
Right.
Andre, you know, Brower. But... It's a big subject, but it's one that I remember there was a, did you ever watch the Ken Burns series, The Civil War?
A little bit, yeah.
The documentary. Mm-hmm. The very last episode of that is, I think, the best one. And there's a historian that puts it so well. She's like, the Civil War wasn't a was. It's an is. It continues. It's not like the war itself continues, but it will never fade away because it shapes us so much.
Yeah.
And being that you were born outside the country, I think that offers a different perspective, I would imagine. Does it on American history?
I was also adopted into a loving family, like, that happened to, like, live in Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. But the big issue, like, why they were having a hard time trying to adopt me was because they didn't want to give me to Americans. They were trying to give me to, like, other people, like Europe and like Denmark and everything, because they didn't have as much of a race issue as they did in America. So they would give more of the white babies to the Americans than people that, like, looked like me. So it was always a little confusing growing up, especially with the effects from, like, the Civil War and, like, redlining and everything as well. So, like, this does have, like, a near and dear place to my heart as, like, all the subject matter with it.
It is, and it's something that, like, and that's case in point how it stays with us. It's not something that was 1865, it just ended. In fact, I was just talking with a gentleman a little while ago about the Ulysses S. Grant memoirs over there. And I think one of the most important things about the war, and that it ushered in a whole new era in so many ways, that Grant is a symbol of that, and that he was, like, he brought in a new era of warfare for, you know, the world, basically. And, you know, that idea of total war was completely his. But the question we asked to start with is, why did it happen? That's a big subject, but I think we could probably work on it, chip away at least right now. What are some reasons that you think brought about not just argumentation between the states, but an all-out war?
From, like, what I was, like, learning and, like, doing a bunch of research on, was more about, like, the North and the South, about where slavery and, like, who could, like, the triangular trade, and, like, was, like, what could declare a citizen and what made up a citizen as well.
Yeah.
Like, those are, like, some of, like, the big marks, like, because those are a lot of things that went into it.
But I think that sums it up really nicely, because as the war was unfolding, as it was actually breaking out, that question of what does it mean to be an American? What is an American? What is a citizen? What is the country? Are we a collection of different states that just happen to be getting along sometimes? Or are we somebody, you know, we should be, you know, working all together on the same accord? And I think about another outsider, somebody else, you know, from outside the country, outside observer, and I can never say his name right, Alexis de Tocqueville. He was a Frenchman who came to America in the 1840s, and he was just, looking, and he wrote a book called Democracy in America. It's just about his what he observed coming to a country. And he noted when he went to the border, but it was on the Ohio River with Kentucky on one side and Ohio on the other of the river. And Kentucky had slavery and Ohio didn't. He said the Ohio side, the free side, was bustling. It was vibrant. It was full of life. It was full of business. People were making deals. They were working hard. The southern side, the Kentucky side that had slavery, the complete opposite. There wasn't that motivation to, you know, like capitalism wasn't alive there because it was just slave, you know, the labor force was all forced labor. So it wasn't, it didn't have that same feel of, you know, like, you know, like a good business person, like if you were to stay at their, come to their restaurant, right? They want to make sure that you have the best service possible. They're super friendly to you. They're bring, you know, they're entertaining you. They're hospitality because they know that you can go somewhere else, right? The competition kind of thing. There's no competition if there's slavery involved in any part of the segment of the labor. So he recognized that right away. And that was something that Northerners, even if they weren't totally opposed to it, even if they totally, you know, didn't want abolition right now, they knew that as the country moved closer and closer to the 20th century, you mentioned before all those European countries, they had gotten rid of slavery, if they even ever had it, long time before. If we're going to be moving towards the 20th century, we can't have this as part of the country anymore and stay a full country. And that was the biggest problem. And it just seemed like, I mean, I don't think we've ever had an era in this country where we're not divided in some way.
Yeah.
That there's two Americas, mm-hmm. at least. You know, I look around. I mean, it seems like that all the time anyway. But it's just, what does that say about the time period, the 1860s, that they were willing to not just turn to violence, but organize violence, uniforms, mm-hmm. marching, taking orders, taking commands. Those drums came on perfect timing for that. I just said, you know, here comes some martial drums as we talk about it. Thank you, Guy. I mean, what does that tell you about that time period that they were willing to resort to an actual killing people by the thousands on the battlefield to sort out those differences?
I believe that it meant like they were willing to die for what they believed in. And I think it was huge, especially that, like what we're talking about, like the 54th Regiment, was that they could actually fight for their like rights a little bit more too. And that they were actually like white and black soldiers like fighting together on the battlefield. But I think it's also just the bravery about it too. Mm-hmm. About how they were able to go and do that, though.
Because in that time period, that seemed to be, that was how you proved that you were a man. Mm-hmm. Like, it wasn't enough just to say things or to write things. You stood behind your convictions and were willing to put your life on the line. Reading people's diaries and things like that, you get a definite sense from both sides of the conflict that it didn't take long before they were like, this is insane. Like, why are we doing this? This is, you know, and if you post Civil War, if you are looking for, and this I think is true for almost any war, if you want to find somebody who hates war, who never wants to be part of it ever again, it's the veterans, right? So a lot of those veterans in the Civil War not only had a disdain for all things violence, but they were the first ones to be willing to make friends with their former enemies.
Yeah.
You know, some of the most touching images I've ever seen is when you see those reunions at places like Gettysburg, where these old men who in their youth were trying to kill each other in the worst terrible ways possible are shaking hands and, you know, hugging and, you know, spending time with each other. And I think, you know, so the thing you selected, the Wax Museum guide thing, came from 1963. Even oldest Civil War veteran would long been dead by, I mean, like, that's 100 years later. Mm-hmm. So it's like, we don't have, this is a whole new era. It's kind of pathetic in a way that we have to tell the story through wax figures by this point. because I don't think they really had the ability to show it in movies quite right yet. I mean, Glory's a fantastic movie. That didn't come out for another 25 years.
But at least it's
being
told, though.
Yeah.
Yeah.
There's attempt to, you know, to try to keep it alive. I went to Gettysburg back in the fall. I've been several times. Have you ever been to Gettysburg?
Not yet.
If you like memorials and monuments, there's like a billion of them. Like, you can't walk 5 feet without a statue, a plaque, some kind of saying, these guys were here, this is what they did. And you can get lost just reading those. You really can't do it in any, you know, you got to give it like several visits to really get the most out of it. But sadly, the town is kind of, you know, it's seen better days tourism wise. You know, in fact, their main Civil War tours museum, that building where all the bus tours went, it burned down like a month after we were there.
Oh.
Like, I have nothing to do with it, but it was like, but when we were in there, I'm like, this place hasn't been updated in a really long time. Mm. And when it comes to museums and getting people excited, and you know from giving your tours in Boston, to get things people interested and excited about, they have to make it relatable.
Yeah.
Right? Like, what did you do when you gave the tours to make it relatable to your...
Well, we got to dress up in a character.
Okay.
So I got to be like a Gen Z ghost because they were really happy that I was like one of the youngest people that they had that actually liked history, like to do tours. So I got to relate it a lot to kids about like, oh, this is like, this is what George Washington would do. And this is like what Lucy would do on Paw Patrol. Like, I would like relate it to like stuff like
awesome.
That.
That's so good.
Yeah. So
I'm
I was
glad
able
they're
to,
doing that.
I was related to like back to kids, but I could also talk to people like from other countries that didn't really understand or like too much about like who Paul Revere was or like, who was this guy? What was the Midnight Ride about? Like, what was that? So I could relate it back to like their history too a little bit.
There's a lot of actually Civil War era history embedded in the way that the Revolutionary War has been commemorated. Mm. If you ever go to Concord, Massachusetts with, you know, Concord Bridge, and that's where, you know, the Revolutionary War began.
Yeah.
There are several plaques and monuments there, probably like three or four. The first one was erected before the Civil War broke out. And then there's another one that came out after the Civil War. And what's interesting is the first one, you know, so it's commemorating 1775. The first one just doesn't really have, it wasn't like a special anniversary. It wasn't like it was the 100th or anything like that. The second one was, and that's what the Civil War did for the country. It put us almost like on the same schedule.
Mm-hmm.
You know, it created a how did historian Shelby Foote put it? He's like, we went from an are to an is. So the United States are, as in multiple different states just happen to get along sometimes, to one country, the United States is, right? Just one country. And you can see that with the statue at Concord Bridge, because the second one, I believe, did come out, like, this is the 100th memorial of that day. And we tend to tell time since the Civil War, decade by decade, don't we? Like, we're like, okay, even when a decade begins, we don't even know what's happening next. You know, there was a lot less celebration in 2020 for other reasons, but, you know, 2020 shows up, we're like, it's the 2020s. Yep. And then it's like, well, we don't know what's going to happen. What are these 20, you know, the 1920s, like, I think they waited until the end before they said, this is what the 20s are all about. Mm. But we got on that schedule, that pattern of like every 10 years is a new era, a new beginning. Mm-hmm. And I think that really starts because you don't see it before the Civil War. Civil War creates that kind of attitude and things like that. So, how much time do you have left? Because I don't want to make you late to get any.
I think I probably have to go because I saw them doing mic checks. So
you're like,
yeah, I probably should go do my mics.
I hope these mics aren't connected there and all these people listening to
them. No.
We're talking about the Civil War again. Thank you so much for stopping by, Abby. I appreciate it.
Thank you.
And good luck on the show tonight.
Thank you so much.
Everything is a Primary Source is building a digital archive, and you can get involved. Perhaps you would like to add to this conversation, or start a new one about history through pop culture. Go to everything-history.com to learn about the Everything is a Primary Source project and how you can take part in this exciting, new, open-source educational resource.